Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
I'm in a bad mood.
Scotty's pissed. Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's an angry episode.
Welcome.
It's a podcast about movies and wine, and for those of you out there who don't know shit about one or the other thing, my name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy. My co-host is mad today.
I'm just... And you know what? You're bringing a low energy here. And I feel like part of my anger is I think you're saying stupid stuff that I am having a hard time disagreeing with. But also, I feel like I have to compensate for your low energy. And I don't know what that's about. You got to bring your energy level up. And I would like mine to come down because I don't like where I'm feeling right now.
Let's meet in the middle.
So why don't you get a little animated and I'm going to here. I've got something that'll make me feel better. Hold the phone here. For the listening audience.
We're in the middle of the intro.
For the listening audience, this will be
I just
nothing.
Told them I'm the wine guy.
But for the viewing audience, this is funsies. And this is funsies for me.
Oh my God. You stupid ass.
if you're only getting the audio portion of this show, because now we've been encouraged to go fully video, I, using a stupid Zoom effect, have some 3D glasses that are just like digitally mapped right onto my face, and they match the 3D glasses that Muppet Me has in the background on my Zoom video.
And we're all very entertained by that.
I am tickled. I'm moving my head around to make sure that the glasses keep tracking. Jimmy is the wine guy. I was just about to. Jimmy is the wine guy. I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. And we, dear listener, are here to help you.
You have a
oh, I thought that was your line. Oh, boy, this episode's going to be terrible. This is going to be one of the all-time worst. I can already tell. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
We tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Usually, we don't.
And sometimes, we just don't even try, like this miniseries.
Correct.
Today, we're continuing, nay, concluding, our four-part miniseries on the Best Picture nominees of the 95th Annual Academy Awards with the final three nominated pictures: Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, Ruben Östlund's The Triangle of Sadness, and Sarah Polley's superlative Women Talking. Jambi, what we drinking?
We are drinking Benedict and Stéphane Tissot Crémant de Jura, non-vintage. It is available at ChambersStreetWines.com, that's ChambersStWines.com, for a mere $34.99 plus tax and shipping.
That's not mere, Jamie. That's not mere.
I know. I'm encroaching on the upper limits of what you like to spend for wine.
You have exceeded the upper limit of what I like to spend on wine.
Too bad.
$24.99 is the upper limit of what I will spend on a bottle of wine, except when. Bottles are just ordered for me, and then I'm told about them later.
Yeah, which is what this is.
That's right.
There was earlier this week, there was an article in, I think, the New York Times?
The New York Times.
Consulting some out there saying that if you want quality wine, you should spend no less than $30 a bottle. And while I don't agree with that, I do think that you should be open to new experiences and a $35 bottle.
I mean, I don't have much choice here.
No, I don't think
that this is exclusive and that you are leaving out people who cannot afford a $34.99 bottle and other such things that make me feel better about myself and lesser about you. Those are the things that I feel
okay,
about
good.
What you just said.
Great. Love it.
Not everybody can afford $34.99, Jamie, and not everybody wants to afford $34.99, and I don't want to afford it.
We have given plenty of options for wines under $34.99.
That's true. So this is a non-vintage wine.
Correct.
I don't understand. It was made in a year, right? It had to have been.
Well, Scotty, too hottie.
See, I'm giving you a perfectly organic sounding setup, and then you come in sounding like this is a scripted bit, and it's not.
It's not a scripted bit. So let me get this bottle open before I explain anything.
I ain't no... Oh my God, it's foaming all over the place. Son of a bitch. Still going.
Oh, man.
All right. I'm going to go get a towel.
Okay.
Jamie's having an asthma attack. Hopefully he doesn't like seize up and die from laughter while I'm gone.
I'll compose myself. I just think it's very funny.
And when I come back with a towel and dry clothes, I have to change for a fucking podcast recording. You can explain what I did wrong and what one can do to prevent the iconic champagne bottle fountaining all over themselves. I'll be back in a moment. I am not having a good time today. Fuck.
Oh my God.
All right. So
now Scott
explain
is covered
what
in
just
wine.
Happened. What why did that happen? Cuz this is the fourth bottle we've done in mm-hmm. four recordings and that hasn't happened to me before. So is it a problem with the bottle? With my methodology? I didn't shake it at all.
No. I mean sometimes it just happens. You know, like every now and then if you are opening a Coke can, it fizzes over. You know, it's not like just when you shake it, but it's about temperature and movement. Those are the big reasons that a wine will overflow like that.
So what is the temperature problem? I had this chilled. Should this not have been chilled?
No, colder is better. I'm saying you didn't do anything wrong. It just happens sometimes.
That's not a good answer. There has to be a better answer than that. Then it just happens sometimes.
It happens sometimes. These are like this. So we could go, I guess, if we want to dive a little bit deeper.
I asked the goddamn question.
You did ask the question.
And since I'm covered in wine and have been yelling and I'm cranky about it, at the very least, we should generate some capital C content, Jamie. And maybe explain to people why it happens sometimes. And if you don't have an answer because you don't know, just say that. And that's okay.
I would say that.
That's
Scott.
Totally fine.
Sometimes it happens. Wine is a fermented product. In fact, this is a product that was fermented twice. And they use minimal sulfur in the production. Sulfur is the thing that will mitigate any amount of further fermentation within the bottle. Okay. During transport. So it's possible that there was maybe a little extra ferment that happened in your bottle that didn't happen in mine, or a little unevenness of disgorgement or dosage in your bottle over mine. There's, you know, it's in a small production artisanal product like this, every bottle is not necessarily identical. Sometimes it happens due to microbial or other reasons.
So I did nothing wrong.
Mm-mm. No, you're perfect.
So it happened a second time. We can even review the video clip. In fact, I may do that for the video audience. I'll repeat it and maybe slow it down so we can all watch it and see. But I opened it, took the little cage off.
Uh-huh.
Got the cork out. Was holding it straight up and down like this.
Yep.
Now, in the previous ones, I think I've been doing it at more of an angle. Does that change anything?
It's best to do it at an angle.
Okay, why? Why does that make
a difference?
To be
honest, it's just been like told to me, and it has been my experience that it's better that way.
All right. Well, I'm giving you homework then for our next recording. I would like you to find an answer.
Sure.
Ask someone or do some research and find an answer why the angled thing. Because this needs to have meaning, Jamie. All right?
It's a valid question that I never thought to ask.
This is a terrible thing that happened to me and to dozens of listening and potentially viewing audiences. And I need to make meaning of it.
Sometimes sparkling wine gets all over you. That's what happens.
And
man.
I just...
And we're going to find out why. We're going to
find
dig
out
in.
Why. Okay, but so we don't know why the bottle being angled makes a difference. But so I opened it and then got the little geyser in the fountain.
Mm-hmm.
And then took a little chug here. And drank some off to try and catch it.
Right. And then bubbled
put it
over
down,
again.
And then it happened again.
Yeah.
So is that so the reason for that initial bubblation was still happening?
A little bit. And also just the act of like putting it to your mouth and then putting it back down jostled the wine extra, mm-hmm. which created even more effervescence. Because when you agitate something with CO2 in solution, the CO2 comes out of solution.
It's just very undignified. It's just,
yeah.
I knew this would happen someday on the show. I always hoped it would happen to you.
a little tip that's not foolproof, but that I have found to be helpful is when removing the cork from a sparkling wine bottle, keep a firm hold on the cork so that it doesn't pop out, making that sound. That's partly like proper service. You don't actually want that popping sound, but two.
But the pop is so iconic.
The pop is iconic, whatever. But the pop also frequently is accompanied by a fountain of sparkling wine. And keeping control over the cork and allowing yourself to feel how much pressure is behind the cork can allow you to maybe tip the cork a little bit and relieve some of that pressure gradually so that you can avoid what happened to you.
But this has to be like a muscle memory thing, right? This is like a practice thing. You got to open a lot of bottles to eat, because what you're describing makes sense to me.
But it requires you to understand the sensation of...
Yeah, I have no sensitivity to what the feeling of the pressure coming out of the mouth of the bottle is like.
Correct.
It happens instantaneously.
But if you really keep a grip on the cork and you like get a feel for whether it is gripping the sides of the bottle and you are pulling it out, or if it like is more free and like ready to just pop out the end, that gives you a good idea of sort of how you can adjust, or it gives someone with the experience of having opened thousands of bottles of sparkling wine that information. So my advice to you, Scott, is just to open more sparkling wine.
Well, as far as this one goes, aside from I'm getting a hint of shame and, you know, a waft of waste and embarrassment. But beyond that, a lot of citrus. Like lemon, like fresh lemon juice, like biting into a lemon kind of flavor. Yep. Jamie, there's some cat pee in this, isn't there? There's some flavor of cat pee. The flavor of the aroma of cat pee.
I don't get any cat pee.
Oh yeah, it's there. It's there. I think you need to unfuck your palate there, buddy, because there are strong notes of cat pee.
Yeah, I'm gonna go ahead and disagree with you on that one.
I'm not hating the cat pee, I gotta tell you. But there's citrus, like lemon. How acidic? Because I'm not feeling super salivate-y, and yet there's a burn. Is that the alcohol, or is that something else that's giving me that burn?
Like burn, a back of the throat burn? Back of the throat?
Yeah.
I don't know. That would be alcohol.
This is a 12.5.
Yeah. So not hugely alcoholic. I'm not really getting a burn.
Getting a burn.
I'd say it's medium to medium plus acid. You know, it's pretty relatively easygoing as far as that's concerned. I don't
dry.
Get it.
The bonest of dry.
Totally dry.
Completely dry.
I get this big herbal component.
What kind of herbs are you getting? That's insane to me.
Like lemongrass and lemon verbena and like chamomile tea, in that sort of realm of things.
No, I must disagree. I'm getting mostly fresh lemon juice. Is there a salt thing? There's a salination or something.
I'm yeah.
Some kind of saline and cat pee.
Salty cat pee.
Salty lemony cat pee.
Yeah, I definitely get a salinity here. It's like a dusty stone character, but also like a sea breeze kind of thing.
It's strong. Is there a scale for salinity? Do we say medium, medium plus, medium minus?
We don't do that for salinity. Kind of, it exists or it doesn't, and it's driving the flavor or it isn't. And I don't think it's driving it, but I do think that it's there.
I think it's present.
Yeah. I also get like a baked apple kind of thing.
Not at all. What? Baked apple? In this wine?
Yeah. That like pastry crust, like baked apple with cinnamon and nutmeg.
I'm not getting any kind of baking spices or anything.
Scott, are you having a stroke?
No. Do you think it has something to do with my faulty bottle of wine here?
It's
possible. Is it some kind of like sulfurous byproduct? Because I'm getting a distinct back of throat burn and a cat pee stank. Or a cat pee taste, without having tasted cat pee. I know you've tasted all the various breeds of cat pee.
Yeah. I mean, Himalayan is very different from Siamese, is very different from domestic short hair, is very different from Maine Coon. You know, like they are all very different, and you have to be able to separate these things if you're going to be a successful sommelier.
So anyone listening or viewing, I just need to like give you a gut check here and help provide some context. Jamie, terrible actor. This is not performative. This is not a bit. Jamie has sampled all of the varieties of cat pee.
And dog pee. Labrador Retriever.
The distinction characteristic between... of dog pee versus feline urine.
Oh, well, I mean, you know.
I know there's a textural thing. Feline urine, there's a greasy quality. The mouthfeel is a little more.
It's the
higher
aroma.
Body.
Man, the cat pee stings the nostrils. Cat pee makes you want to vacate the premises immediately.
This is stinging the nostrils. This is making my nose want to vacate the premises.
I am thinking that you got a faulty bottle.
I think I may, because I'm strong.
Because like we've disagreed on the character of wines a bunch. But
we are having wildly divergent experiences.
Yeah, the baked apple thing for me is huge on the palate. And like toasted nuts, the aroma is much more high toned, much more like citrus and fresh fruit.
No fresh fruit at all. So my bottle is fucked.
I think your bottle might be fucked.
I have another bottle of this. I don't really want to open it. I'm a little gun shy. You may imagine why.
And I'm going to guess it's not chilled either.
It is definitely not chilled.
Yeah. So, you know, sorry.
Should I keep drinking it? It's not horrible, but like a lot of lemon. Like,
yeah, it seems like you kind of like it, but it is
no, burning. I don't kind of like it. But I'm still drinking it because that's what I'm supposed to, Jamie, because I'm trying to be a professional. Okay. I'm trying to be as professional of an amateur as I can be.
Right.
Oh, there's like a burnt smell on the nose, like a burnt cat pee, like when the cat pees on a radiator or something.
That is a descriptive way to put that.
Is cat pee a signature aroma of sparkling whatever this is having gone bad?
No, cat pee is a signature aroma of Sauvignon Blanc, usually from New Zealand, and there is none of that grape. Or that place in this wine.
What are the grapes in here, in this non-vintage wine?
It is mostly Chardonnay, a little bit of Pinot Noir, and an even smaller bit of Poussard and Trousseau.
And those are all grapes?
Yep.
I'm familiar with two of those grapes.
Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and then Poussard and Trousseau are both red grapes that originate in the Jura area, which is where this wine is from. You don't see a ton of Poussard or Trousseau planted elsewhere. Trousseau is also known in Portugal as Bastardo, and you see it there mostly in blends, although there are some varietal wines from coastal Portugal that are really nice. Poussard, I haven't really heard of much outside of the Jura, but they tend to be like light-bodied, really herbal, intense red wines from this area. I very much like Poussard and Trousseau.
All right. Help me, because you know I'm suggestible about the flavors.
Yeah.
What do you think the bottle that you're drinking out of would taste like if it had gone off? Are there a lot of ways for something to go off?
Yeah, there are a number of different ways. Like it can be bacterial infection. You know, there's a thing called mousiness.
You've described mousiness before.
Yeah, and it's mostly a thing on the palate, and it's textural, mostly. It's like the beginning part of the wine, the front palate, will taste mm-hmm. fine, and then as you swallow the wine, you get kind of like a fuzzy textural sensation towards the back of your mouth that can be quite unpleasant.
No fuzziness, no. So what else?
Oxidation is another fault that can happen. Oxidation or heat damage, both of which can express themselves with like overripe to cooked fruit flavor, like a raisinated kind of situation, or like an extremely nutty, like an Oloroso sherry kind of character.
No nuttiness, no nasty sherry notes either. What else? What other ways could this be fucked? You said that if it continued fermenting, or if too much sulfur,
that would just be if there was another fermentation that took place after the second fermentation, that would give you off flavors, and it could be something akin to cat pee. I don't know. I'm not in the room with you. I wish I was to like check that bottle. Scott's making an ugly face.
Well, it's just like it's super citrusy, which I like, and it's very sour, which is not like my favorite, but the citrus notes are interesting, and I'm liking the acid. And once again, we have these are another small bubbles, right? We got the tiny bubbles here.
Yep. Very fine, very persistent perlage.
Mm. Yeah, I'm just not getting anything in the other than lemon. I'm not getting any of these fruit notes. I'm not getting any baking seasoning notes at
no,
all.
No nuttiness.
No
like,
nuttiness. Just like a lot of saline, a lot of lemon, and a lot of back of the throat burn. The smell is not as offensive now as it was when I first poured it. But when I first poured the second glass, the stank was something fierce. Strong of the cat pee.
Maybe pour yourself like a significant portion and let it sit for, I don't know, 10 minutes or so. And revisit. Also, I find it funny that your Zoom is reading your arm as green screen.
What are you talking about?
Whenever you put your arm up, our logo is on it.
You mean like this?
Yeah.
Right here?
I can, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Are you wearing a green glove or something?
Bet your ass I am. This green screen came from a Christmas gift that Pri and Adam recommended I get for the child. And it's like a little kid's like, you know, make a green screen movie with your toys and shit. But if you want to manipulate the toys, you got to be able to get your hands in there.
Mm.
And I found the thing, and he and I are going to put it to some use, I think, in the coming weeks once he finishes this custom Lego castle that we're working on. There we go. There's some Jamie in there. My green screen is not big enough to fully cover the area behind me. But now if I just hold my hand up here,
it's
the entire
perfect.
Time,
yeah,
we can see everything. But see, then they can see Muppet Jamie, so we'll just take it away.
Muppet Jamie is the best, though.
Muppet Jamie's pretty good. If we're being truthful, and this is no, you know, this is no mark against Ross and his fine work on our logo, which I love, but Muppet Jamie captures your essence more than Muppet Scott captures mine.
Well, I think that's a function of the format that we ended up choosing, right? Like, I am a Muppet.
You have a triangle mouth. You are a Muppet.
You are not.
I am a human.
Right.
And not made of felt with some sweaty puppeteer in a contorted position under a table with his arm up my ass.
That's correct.
Up your ass.
Yep.
All right. So I poured this glass. I'm going to set it aside for several minutes.
So, like, what I'm getting from this wine on the nose is salinity, minerality, citrus, and herbs. Like that's this like, and it's pretty aromatically intense for me. And then I take it to the palate and it's got decent acidity, but that's not what's driving the thing. It's got a very, it's full bodied for a sparkling wine. And it's giving me like toasted walnuts and baked apple and maybe a little bit of like candied citrus on the palate as well. I find this wine to be beautiful. It's delicious. I would like some more. And in fact, I'm going to have another sip.
Boy, yeah. I mean, I know our tastes don't always line up. In fact, they usually don't. But yeah, you are describing something very different from what is in my bottle.
Mm. God, it's good. It's really good.
Nope.
I had never had this particular bottling from this producer before. In following with what I've been doing for most of this mini series, I chose this wine on reputation and also on having had wine from this producer before and being interested to try their sparkling wine. You asked me about non-vintage wine about 3 years ago, and I never answered you.
It was an age of Middle Earth ago. That's right. Yeah. Yes. Well, because I was asking you about it, and then the bottle erupted all over me.
Correct. Yeah. So most sparkling wine that gets bottled is non-vintage wine. The idea behind it is that many sparkling wine regions actually struggle year to year to get fruit to optimal ripeness levels. And so as a way to create a consistent product, they blend vintage to vintage, and make a non-vintage blend in a house style. They're always sort of chasing what this wine should taste like year to year. That's very true in Champagne. It's very true in Prosecco and variously true elsewhere. Obviously this, you know, this is made in a year. The important part is on the back label here. You see, it says disgorged May, 2022. So what that means is this wine was about 2 years prior, set down to with its, liqueur de tirage, or the extra sugar and yeast that they use to incite a second fermentation, and then slowly turned upright to get the lees to, the neck of the bottle, and then disgorged, as we've previously described, in May of 2022, capped, with a champagne cork and labeled and sold. And it took until, you know, last month for it to get to us.
Have you had previous non-vintage wines from this producer, or do you normally just get the vintages?
I've had vintage still wine from this producer.
And fortified wine
from this producer. So this is the first sparkling that I've had from them.
Do they allow for a lot of variety from vintage to vintage?
A ton of fucking variety. Huge amount. It's very much up and down. You know, the 17s are completely different from the 18s, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm probably betraying my ignorance here.
That's what we're here to do.
Ellipsis, which is like, put that on my fucking t-shirt for the show. Finally, you're never threatening to get me t-shirts from things that I say, but I'm threatening to make you t-shirts all the time. I'm a much better friend than you are for threatening to make you embarrassing t-shirts of dumb shit that you said. But betraying my ignorance, I admit that I am. Why is there so much, like, because not every producer that we've talked about has so much variety from vintage to vintage.
Yes.
Like, some of them have, some of them don't. Is it a geography and a climate thing that, like, the seasons vary from year to year, or is it just allowing for, like, I don't know.
It's a combination of all of those things.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the Jura is a cold climate region. It's got a shortened growing period. They bud really, really late. And sometimes they're harvesting into December because they are just, like, struggling so much to make sure that the grapes get ripe at all. So in these regions, the variation in the field is very, very high. Add to that the fact that this is a natural producer. So biodynamic farming, trying to do the least in the cellar to the wines that they possibly can, with obviously the exception of this, of sparkling wine, which itself is a process, but, you know, native yeast fermentation, no new oak, that type of thing. That is a breeding ground for an awful lot of variation. Cooler climates generally have the biggest variability. Like the Finger Lakes in New York, wildly variable in its vintage character, but Napa Valley, not as much. Although becoming much more with the presence of wildfires as a complexing factor.
But this is a pro for the wine drinker, right? The wildfire is making it better.
Nope.
Except for all the fields and plots that are being destroyed.
No, generally we don't like smoke tainted wine. It doesn't.
We don't like smoke taint.
No.
Is there any taint that we do like? We don't like cork taint. We don't like smoke taint. I guess taint by its nature is not desirable.
I like my taint.
Apparently I can't respond to that because I'll be offending the taint loving communities.
Oh man. So taint
by its own definition.
It's bad. It's a pejorative thing.
You not speaking anatomically, despite Jamie's fondness for it. It means it makes something, it imparts a thing that is not desirable in a thing that otherwise you want to be desirable.
Correct, yes.
To taint. So there are no good taints.
No.
There's good cat pee, but there's no good taints.
That's correct.
Okay. I think I understand. I don't fully understand how they managed to maintain a house style by pooling grapes over time. I don't know. Maybe I'm having brain damage from sulfur or anything is in this wine. But like, if there's so much variety from season to season, then how does this bottle, like how often do they bottle this particular non-vintage product?
Once a year.
But there's still variety from year to year. So how does that variety not make its way into the finished product?
Okay.
You're going to tell me you've explained this twice already.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I have, but I wasn't going to say that.
Okay. Fair. Please continue.
Consider a 5-year span, right?
Okay.
2015 to 2020.
Sure. I'm aware of those years. They were very good. Everything that happened in them was wonderful for everyone.
2015, very, very hot. Extremely hot. 2016, almost as hot. 2017, very, very cool. Very cool and wet. 2018, once again, extremely hot. 2019, more moderate. Now, utilizing three of those, call them paints in your palette, across 5 years, you can create a similar feeling wine as each of those wines age and utilizing the character of each vintage to create something that is roughly in line with what you did the previous year.
So they're discarding fruit from the years that don't fit into the general, like that don't fit into the standard deviation of the climatological mean.
Not necessarily, no.
So but you just said they're using product from three harvests, from 3 years.
So let's say you're making in those 5 years, you've got 2015 to 2019 is what I described. Let's say you start in 2018 making wine and you make a wine from 15, 16, and 17 fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Then you make wine in 2019 and you use a different blend, adding in fruit from 2019 to arrive at something that tastes relatively similar to what you did the previous year.
Okay.
It's a process of blending and tasting.
Yes. But so it we're still not achieving an identical product in the bottle every time.
No, not identical. But
close. They're getting close. So like in 5 or 10 years time, this same non-vintage cuvée could taste radically different from what I'm drinking now. Maybe not radically, but like it would taste, if the climate, let's say hypothetically, continues to get more fucked as time goes on.
Yep. Hypothetically like, speaking.
Year after year, or more like decade after decade, this will drift further and further away from what we're drinking right now.
Yeah. And also, if you're looking at timescales of decades, then eventually the winemaker changes and that person's palate is different.
Stop introducing variables. I have a very, like, I'm trying to simplify it to understand what you're talking about. And then you're bringing in fucking people into it because you're Jamie and you love bringing in the people and the stories.
I like people, Scott.
I know
you're a
people.
Misanthrope and you hate all people.
I'm not a misanthrope. I just don't care for you sometimes. I have enjoyed you greatly on our recent recordings, and today you got off on the wrong foot with me, and I don't care for it.
Scott's mad because I was right about something, and he's upset.
Well, I'm not used to that happening. I'm not prepared. I don't have the tools in my tool bag of emotions to deal with Jamie being right about something. And I'm not responding like a mature person, and I'm covered in stanky cat pee, not champagne.
Oh, man. So
this still smells terrible. It's been 13 minutes, and it stinks.
Okay, yeah. You've got a fucked bottle. I'll leave it to you to decide if you want to, like, pause right now and try and open your other bottle or to, like, wait for another time and you and your wife can enjoy that bottle together and hopefully it's unfucked.
But it won't taste as good if it's room temp.
No, and also it's far more likely to explode on you again if it's room temp.
Nope. Not happening. We're done. At a certain point, I'm going to go refill my water bottle and maybe get a glass of bourbon or something and we can continue. We are
That's
not
such
opening
a bummer.
That.
I hate that.
It's not my favorite thing that's happened
yeah,
ever.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that it's not my wine because mine is delicious over here.
Douchebag.
Don't worry, Scotty. We'll drink more sparkling wine together. It'll be okay. Ooh, it's really good.
You know what? I'm going to save the other bottle of this for the Oscar party, and we'll open it, and you'll tell me if, and I'll tell you if this tastes the same.
Yeah, you tell me first if it tastes the same, and then I'll tell you, yeah. So, briefly, because we've been droning on and on kind of about the wine and the flaws and vintage and non-vintage and all of that, but this is from Bénédicte and Stéphane Tissot. They are the second generation of growers. The winery is still properly called Domaine André et Mireille Tissot, as an homage to the parents. They farm about 35 hectares. They make 28 different cuvées. I made note on our last episode that I was impressed that Laurent Barthe made as many cuvées as he did. These guys take it to an even further extreme.
Right, because Laurent Barthe had 28 and he made 10, right?
So yeah, he had 28 single plots in 4 hectares and made 10 cuvées.
Well, these guys have 35 hectares. How many plots do they have?
A lot. I don't know.
Well, then how do we know if it's impressive or not?
It's impressive that even just having 28 different bottlings, different labels to go to market with is like a lot. To subdivide your land so in such a granular way. And it's not just by terroir, right? It's not just by the single plot of land. It's also about the process, because in the Jura, one of the traditional ways of making wine is called souvoil, which we have encountered before as underfloor in sherry. There are very sherry-like wines that come from the Jura.
So in Spain, we call it underfloor, and in France, we call it souvoil.
Souvoil, which just souvoil. Means under veil.
But veil is the same as floor.
I mean, it refers to the same thing, but it translates as a different thing.
Okay.
Because they're different languages.
Thank you. I wasn't sure. I thought everyone in France and Spain all spoke the same language, which is English. Oh, wait. They largely do.
They all do. Most of them do.
Because they're better than we are.
They sure are. So the Tissot wines early on in the natural wine movement in the late 80s into the 90s sort of established themselves as leaders in the field. And they also were part of a movement away from souvoil winemaking into what's called topped-up winemaking or reductive winemaking, not allowing the veil to grow, and instead aging wines in the absence of oxygen, and making more traditional wines from Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Poussard, Savinien, and Trousseau. I've found their wines to be extremely impressive. I do tend to think that the top-end cuvées are more expensive and less easy to find than I would like them to be. They're very good, but it's a lot.
Are they harder to find because, like, is it a smaller production thing, or they're just that they're so good that the demand is higher?
It's both.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, 35 hectares is not a big estate, but it's not a small one either. It's the Tissot family and the Ganavat family are like the leaders in the Jura, and those producers are almost synonymous with the region. And so it is difficult to find bottles of either, and the prices have risen, you know, because capitalism, supply and demand, economics, and other things that I don't fully understand.
I explained supply and demand to the 6-year-old the other day.
Yeah? How'd that go?
I feel like I did a pretty good job of it, and I'm kind of surprised because I barely passed macroeconomics in high school.
Well, as I recall, Scott, during your macroeconomics class, you were very frequently cutting class with me.
Yeah, and I never once drew a supply and demand curve graph accurately in any of the many exams and quizzes we had in that course.
Wasn't that the first block class that you had that you would cut with me because I had late arrival?
You had late arrival and I had macroeconomics, and I thought it was fine to not go to there. And
what was the name of your teacher?
Mr. Mullen.
Who passed you out of the goodness of his heart.
Yeah, I believe one of the only calculations I did for that whole class was calculating what my grade would be, and it should have been in the 40% range. And he passed me with a D-, and that's when I learned that a D- is still passing somehow.
Jesus Christ. Yep. We were great students in high school.
I am still a bad student now. Jamie, explain to me what non-vintage means, please.
Oh, my God.
I got some tummy scrumbos. I got some burning in my digestive region. I'm a little worried that this wine is making me ill.
It's probably not the wine.
It might be.
What did you have for breakfast?
I had yogurt with granola and a banana.
That seems like a pretty safe
It was pretty breakfast. Safe, pretty benign breakfast. Hits yeah. most of the nutritional baselines.
Anyway, this is the Jura. It's a traditional method, sparkling wine from the Jura, which is, you know, a hypey region of France, but I think a worthy one to taste wines from and to understand. I've loved Tissot's wines. I was pouring Ganavat's blend of Gamay and Chardonnay at the bar a couple of weeks ago. That was beautiful. You know, I understand why people like lost their shit when Jura wines came into style. And my only regret is that there aren't that many of them. Some of the ones that are available are not very good and don't paint a great picture of the area. And I would like to drink them some more because I like them because they're tasty. Really well with raclette. And I love raclette.
Raclette is a very stanky cheese.
It's not that stanky.
It's fairly stanky.
But it's so good. You melt it under those raclette grills and then
familiar.
You put it on either a baguette or onto potatoes.
I've done it well. It's been so done good. Here. My wife loves to melt down a good raclette over an open flame. I have enjoyed it. But let's not say it's not a stanky. It's a stanky cheese.
It's stinky, but it doesn't register as like that stinky to me. It definitely has a stank to it, which I think would go quite well with this wine. And
it
I know
might even
for sure,
go well with this bottle that I have, which is extremely stanky.
With that fucked bottle that you have, I feel so bad. That's such a bummer.
You know what? I'm gonna call it. Odds are 50-50 that when we open my other bottle of this together, that it's probably going to taste exactly like this, and you're going to be sniffing your own farts and telling me how fucking delicious it is, and I'm going to be like, no, this is like cat pee and salt water.
Well, either way, we can have someone else film us, and we'll put it on the internet for the content.
For the C word. For the content minds.
Do you have any other questions about this wine, the Jura sparkling wine?
Well, you put this in a context, since I'm seemingly drinking a very bad bottle of it. Put the correct tasting version of it in a timeline with the previous three that we've had this many series. Yeah.
So the reason I wanted to bring this to taste this one last is that my supposition was, and I believe it to be correct, that this would be the richest, fullest, and most traditional tasting sparkling wine. That this one would be the closest maybe to capital C champagne. And while capital C champagne, I don't think often gets as herbal as I think this is, the structural components are all there, and it's made obviously with care, and they take a lot of time aging it in bottle with its lees. So it has that like extra breadth, and gravitas to it. So I wanted it to be the finisher because it seems like the biggest meal of the four wines that I chose for this miniseries.
Speaking of foods, so you've already made cheese pairing suggestions for an unfucked bottle of this wine.
Yep, raclette.
What would you recommend I pair with my bottle, which is gross and nastified?
I would recommend opening a new bottle that is not fucked.
Okay, but if I didn't want to do that and needed to eat food quickly because, I don't know, do any of the things that may have gone wrong with this bottle increase alcohol content? Because I've had one modest glass and half of like a full glass.
And you're feeling extra
feeling
buzzed?
Pretty buzzed does not begin to describe it. I'm like on the lower end of drunk.
Interesting. Well, that adds credence to maybe this was just an extra fermentation that happened.
in the bottle, and that mm-hmm. turned more sugar into alcohol.
Yeah. And more CO2, which would account for the extra bubbles that ended up in your lap.
Science. See, it's not a thing that just happens. We have taken evidence and used a reasonable and educated supposition from a person such as yourself, and we have come to a conclusion. So an extra fermentation happened in my bottle.
It is very possible, yes.
And remind me again, because it was an hour of arguing ago, why did an extra fermentation likely happen in this bottle?
They don't use any sulfur. And
sulfur stops fermentation.
The sulfur stops any microbial activity, and yeast is a microbe. And if there was yeast and any amount of sugar, it's very possible that more fermenting happened.
And why did that happen in my bottle and not your bottle? Was it native yeast inside the bottle? Was the bottle not sanitized? How? Why me and not you? Why me, Jamie?
It could have been yeast on the cork that they used on your bottle. Mm. It could have been a contamination of the dosage that they used prior to corking. These things are each bottle, once it's separated, once they're, you know, put into a bottle from a tank, they are different things, and different things happen to them. They're like twins with diverging lives. Identical at the outset, but at the conclusion, something totally different.
All right, I'm going to go pee and refill my water bottle, because otherwise I'm just going to keep drinking this, and I'm not enjoying it, and I think it's making me ill. Is there any danger of me getting ill? Because I'm feeling the same burn in my tums that I was feeling in the back of my throat.
I do not believe that there is any chance of you getting sick from this bottle of wine. But like, you know, things happen.
Oh. And in the spirit of the show, I'm not switching to water. I have an open bottle here, so I'm going to have other wine.
Quelques rouilles.
Are you familiar with this one, with this vintage?
I know that appellation. That is Clos Fousset. I don't know the Clos Fousset
2020 white Loire wine.
Loire Valley Sauvignon Blanc.
It was
from an area called Rouilles.
It was at the Ye Olde PLCB Fine Wine and Good Spirits store, and it was one of their premium collection wines, still for $19.99.
Do you like it?
Yeah, it's all right. It's fine. As far as dry Sauvy Bees go.
Smells a little bit like...
smells like pineapple. It smells like mango. Mmm. But yeah, this, delicious. No campy. A little bit of cat pee.
Little cat pee.
A little tiny bit of cat pee.
It's Sauvy Bee.
It's mostly dry, not like fully dry, but pretty dry.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of that like bitterness and like a scotch of the coconut, which I'm not crazy about. Some fruit, some citrus fruit, some tropical fruit. Much better. Doesn't taste horrible.
A good, bright Sauvy Bee. We love it.
Indeed. All right.
Are we ready for movie times?
I feel like it's time. I feel like it's time for movie times.
It's past time for movie times.
I mean, I fucking agree, but you kept fucking answering questions that I was asking, which was a mistake on your part.
Yeah, it probably was.
Yeah.
Motherfucking.
Yeah, so here we go. We're talking about Elvis. Let's talk about Elvis. Elvis.
A movie not about Elvis.
I mean, it is about Elvis. It's about Elvis.
It's kind of about the Colonel.
It's Elvis through the prism of Colonel Tom Parker.
Sure.
Like, Amadeus is about Mozart, even though it's told by Salieri, which feels like it was an intentional touchstone for this movie.
Oh, God, I didn't even think about that. Sure.
Yeah. It's not as good as Amadeus. I might argue it's largely not very good. Anyway. So it's Elvis. It's Baz Luhrmann. He's back doing his Baz Luhrmann thing, which, depending on how much you enjoy that particular thing, is either makes this a must-watch or a, like, desperately avoid for you. Austin Butler plays Elvis Presley in a structurally conventional biopic that follows the king of rock and roll from his early days all the way to his tragic death. As mentioned, the film is in that Amadeus mold, told from the point of view of the antagonist, Elvis's manipulative lifelong manager, Colonel Tom Parker, played by Tom Hanks in a fat suit doing some kind of borderline offensive Eastern European accent, a performance that NPR's Glenn Weldon likened to Watto, the slave-owning Toydarian junk trader from The Phantom Menace. And if you're anything like me, once you hear that comparison, it is impossible to unhear it. Elvis was a big honkin' hit last summer. It grossed $150 million in the U.S. and $287 million worldwide. It got largely positive reviews from critics, and now it's a major Oscar player with 7 nominations. Best Picture, Best Actor for Austin Butler, who I have heard has finally dropped the Elvis voice that he's been stuck with for a few years. Best Makeup and Hairstyling, Best Sound, Best Cinematography, Best Film Editing, and Best Production Design. It is currently available for your streaming pleasure on HBO Max or wherever you get your VODs. Jamie, I kind of liked this for like the first hour and then really burnt out. What were your feelings on the old Baz Luhrmann's Elvis?
I kind of liked it for the first 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And then it was a slog after that. And I remember at one point thinking to myself, okay, good. This thing must be winding down. I'm almost done. I really don't want to sit here any longer because I'm having a bad time, and I'm glad that this feels like it's finishing up. And then I hit pause to look at the timestamp, and I was just under halfway through, and I threw the remote into the air and stomped around my living room in a comic fashion, and then turned it back on, and remained standing for a further like 15 minutes because I was mad about it.
Really? You stood up for 15 minutes of the movie?
Yes.
Really? You're not, this isn't a bit?
This is not a bit. I was standing because I was like simultaneously overstimulated and profoundly bored.
This is the movie for me that like, I'm pretty sure will make it so that I can never go back and enjoy earlier Baz Luhrmann movies. This is kind of the moment for me where, like, when I saw Batman v Superman, and it was like the Emperor had no clothes, and suddenly I went back and watched some of the Zack Snyder movies that I enjoyed before. Like, I had enjoyed Watchmen before, but I always had kind of, like, this, like, asterisk with it. I don't know if you remember, after we saw Watchmen on opening night, and we were like with a big group of people in the, you know, parking lot of the multiplex. And I took you aside and I'm like, you've never read the book because you can't read. It's like one of my favorite pieces of fiction. I was too close to it. I'm like, I can't tell if this is a good movie. And you were like, I'm pretty sure it's a good movie. But I've long had that suspicion with Watchmen. I think I watched it like the day after I saw Batman v Superman. And I was like, oh, no. Oh, no. Like this is hot dog shit. And this is kind of how I feel with Elvis, where like it finally, like, I don't think I could ever watch Moulin Rouge ever again. I don't think I could ever watch Romeo plus Juliet ever again. Moulin Rouge, a movie that I loved 20 years ago.
The both of us, we were all about it. We would ride around in my fucking 92 Subaru Loyale, blasting the soundtrack, singing it out the damn windows.
Roxanne!
I remember those days. We loved
those
that
shit.
Those
were the days.
I'm interested to go back to that one. I also would be interested to watch Strictly Ballroom.
I have never seen Strictly Ballroom.
I remember watching it with my mother as a wee child. And not fully getting it, but being engaged by the visuals, and it was one of those movies where I was like, this has to be what adults like. that's the lasting impression that I got from Strictly Ballroom.
You did not like it, but you were like, ah, yes, when I'm an adult, this will be the type of thing that I enjoy.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. That is an excellent way to put that. Yeah.
And I haven't watched it since. So I would be interested to see that. I'm interested to revisit Moulin Rouge because I think it's been about as long for me as it has for you since I've seen that movie.
Yeah.
Probably since like just after high school.
You probably haven't seen anything he's made since then, right? You didn't see Australia.
Nope.
Nobody did. That was an enormous flop and not good. Did you see Gatsby? His Gatsby?
I did not, no.
I have a great dislike for his Gatsby.
Yeah, I remember you having that take, and that was during a period of time where I basically didn't watch many movies, and the ones that I did were uniformly co-signed by you.
Mm.
So I just I missed that one entirely.
Well, so I think Baz Luhrmann, and this is why Elvis is a problem for all of his other movies, and my extreme dislike of it is a problem for me personally. And I will say, this is not like the universal take. Like, it has like a, I don't know, 78% or something on the Rotten Tomatometer. And there's a lot of very smart critics who I really like who are big fans of the movie, and it was a big hit. Like, you know, this is not conventional wisdom here. But for me personally, like, he makes the same fucking movie every time.
Right.
Like, if you describe Elvis in the arc of its tone and rhythm and, like, kineticism, it is exactly the same as Moulin Rouge and as Romeo plus Juliet and as his Great Gatsby adaptation. I only saw Australia the one time and don't really recall enough of it to apply the comparison there. But the first half is hyper-kinetic and flashy and lurid and rapid cutting and dizzying, and the tone is extremely heightened. And it's silly and it's immersive and it's flashing lights and the camera's always fucking whirling all over the place. And it's a ton of montage and overlapping music and dialogue, and it gets you drunk. And then the second half, suddenly they slam on the brakes and the dramatic stakes get heightened. All the dramatic stakes that he was setting up in the first half get heightened, and it's the hangover, and it's a major bummer, and it downshifts in terms of energy and pace and rhythm into something much more like a conventional drama. It's no longer the lurid energy of Christian falling in love with the Moulin Rouge and falling in love with Satine. Now she's got tuberculosis, and now she's being controlled by the evil guy played by Richard Roxburgh, and now there's tragedy afoot, and it's all dour, and it slows down. And there's still the flourishes, but it's not that insane kaleidoscopic montage of the first half. And Elvis does the exact same goddamn thing. Gatsby does the exact same thing. Although I think that movie's kind of fucked from the get-go. But I think the first hour, I had a great time with it. Like, it's hard not to get swept up in the enthusiasm and the energy. And even though I think a lot of it is like, it's a biopic. See, that's how I always want to pronounce that word. I was patting myself on the back before for saying it correctly before. It's a biopic form and, like, narrative structure that I thought Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, had thoroughly murdered dead with its, like, precise and brilliant skewering. And yet, here it is. We're doing another entire life-spanning thing with one, like, major rock star spanning all the ages. And despite, like, all the roteness and the tropiness of it, I think the first hour basically works because Baz is really good when he's in that mode. And that energy is undeniable. And then it's when it starts to get a little bit more serious. And I think it's around the time when, you know, we have to really live in how Elvis felt about Dr. King's assassination that the movie just gets so fucking po-faced and, like, misses its own mark and loses what was enjoyable about it before and asks me to be invested in characters who are broad caricatures in cartoons that at least previously, yeah, they were caricatures in cartoons, but it was fun and it was frothy and enjoyable. And that whole last hour and a half I found agonizing, absolutely agonizing.
Yeah, I was feeling agonized before that.
Hmm.
I think part of it is, it thinks it does a really good job in the beginning of addressing the racial dynamics of Elvis's come up.
Oh, yeah. There is a real, like, 21st century looking back on that and putting a smooth finish that really, like, polishes over all the ugly ends of it.
It's hard not to think that Baz is Australian, right?
He is Australian. Yeah, he's an Aussie.
You don't want to blame someone's nationality for it, but, like, he clearly addresses it. He's unconscious.
The appropriation that Elvis is just black music, but with a white face. And because of opportunistic people like Colonel Tom Parker, now you can sell it and make money off it.
Exactly.
Yes.
But doesn't actually engage with the black people at all.
No, he just has a couple of black musicians there who basically tell him, like, it's okay. They kind of let Elvis off the hook.
They do.
like, whether or not that's factually true, it's almost like the movie would be better without those scenes.
Agreed.
Because those are just like putting a modern, very progressive, and more like aware of the exploitative practices about, you know, black music and the music industry. It feels obligatory.
It feels like an obligatory doffing of the cap to this issue that we all now are conscious of, but it doesn't engage with it in a real way.
No.
And I think, you know, if you're fucking making a movie in 2022 about Elvis, you probably should engage in an honest, deep, and exploratory way with those things. And so that, like, the beginning for me is tainted by giving it the side eye when it does that doffing of the cap. But also, I got really exhausted by the visuals of it very, very quickly.
Oh, it's so draining. And it's his whole thing that, in retrospect, I feel like I would probably find Moulin Rouge impossibly annoying now. Just, like, so grating and overstimulating and, like, desperate for your attention in kind of a pathetic way, you know?
Yeah. It's weird because on paper, this movie should be something that I like. It's a little bit irreverent. It's heightened. It's whimsical. There's no shortage of whimsy around here.
You love whimsy. Whimsy is your favorite thing.
I love it. I just think it does a bad job. And man, Tom Hanks is bad.
Tom Hanks is so bad in it. And I love Tom Hanks.
But I love Tom Hanks too, but he's so fucking bad. Deeply,
profoundly terrible in this movie. It is an awful performance.
Can you think of a worse Tom Hanks performance than this?
Not really. I mean, like, I haven't seen all the Hankses, but, like, this is really terrible. It would be terrible without the fat suit that honestly doesn't look that much better than, like, Mike Myers as Fat Bastard. It's really not that much better. And for the movie to be nominated for, like, makeup and hairstyling, presumably for the big transformative makeup on Tom Hanks here, in the same year when Colin Farrell is completely unrecognizable in totally believable, like, heavier body makeup in The Batman, is just like, this is the worst thing that we think about when you think about, like, oh God, it's a prestigious actor in a fat suit. Like, oh, it looks so bad. No, I think Hanks is deeply and horribly terrible in the movie. And I feel bad saying it because I love Hanks. I love Hanks.
He doesn't need our sympathy or our regret. He's fucking fine.
He's doing great. Hanks is fine. He was having a good time playing Colonel Tom. And he went out and he pitched the hell out of the movie. Playing Watto. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if
Sebulba's gonna win, I promise you that.
I don't know if the Hanks performance is anti-Semitic, if the characterization that Hanks has Colonel Tom putting on is anti-Semitic. Like, if Colonel Tom in all of his, like, manifest, like, because he is very much like a simulation, right? Like, he was not a colonel. The name Tom Parker was an invention. We find out later in the movie, spoilers for American history, that Colonel Tom was, like, not even a U.S. citizen, which is part of why he never wanted Elvis to do a global tour. So much of his characterization is an invention that I, like, maybe Hanks's justification is like, well, maybe Colonel Tom thought he should, like, have an anti-Semitic, like, Eastern European, like, you know, evil, nefarious sounding Jew voice. Like, I don't know, but it's not good. It's not good. And the makeup makes it worse. And I think it's deeply terrible. I will say, I do not really care for this movie at all. Austin Butler is phenomenal as Elvis. I think it's a genuinely great performance. I don't think the movie gives him a lot to do because he, you know, gets to play the whole arc and the rags to riches and the alcohol and the drugs and the being trapped and trying to break out of the mold and then the Vegas residency. And he gets to play all these various things. I think it's a wonderful performance. And it's not just a mimicry, although the mimicry quality is pretty uncanny, especially vocally. I think he's phenomenal, and I just wish the entire movie around him was way better than it actually is.
I guess I'm having trouble separating his performance from, like, the truly terrible writing. Like some of the scenes that he's asked to portray are just horrendous. Like when he's wrestling with needing to enlist in the army or whatever. Yeah. I'm looking at him going like, just all of the lines are bad. And so what am I grasping onto there performance wise?
The things that he's doing with his face and his body.
Sure.
Compelling. Always found him compelling on screen.
I was so quickly put off by this movie that it became a chore so early just to sit there. I felt like I was sitting there for 5 hours.
Yeah, it did. Your perception of time is greatly warped by the experience of this movie, or at least mine was, and apparently yours was as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it felt endless to me. And yet, it goes out on a high note. It ends with, you know, Elvis, like, fat, sweaty Elvis, which is to say, beautiful, svelte Austin Butler in terrible fat suit and terrible fat makeup.
Yep.
As heavy late period Elvis, sweating drunkenly over a piano, doing an extraordinary rendition of Unchained Melody. Like, it ends on a really high note, but your mileage may vary. For you, it was the entire thing that was unbearable. For me, it was just the final 90 minutes of it that was very difficult. One thing I do give it credit for, and I think it visualized it extremely well, is like, we're geriatric millennials, but I don't know if you and your mom ever talked about this, but like my mom would tell me about Elvis and the way that the culture reacted. Cause like she was just at the right age. She was born in 49. And she was like just young enough to kind of like see people looking at him essentially. She wasn't quite in her adolescence when Elvis was coming up, but the way that she would always describe, and, you know, the way that like pop culture and VH1 Behind the Music and all of that shit would describe the culture's reaction to how sexual Elvis was. And, you know, like you see him, like archival footage of him performing on Ed Sullivan, and you're like, yeah, it's a guy fucking dancing. Okay. But the way Baz films it, where like the angle is lower and you're at the point of view of the young women who all seem to be having spectacular orgasms on camera, and like the thrusting and the gyration right up in the screen, like it very subjectively puts you in the point of view of somebody being titillated and excited by like his radical style of dancing. I thought it did all of that extremely well. Like, again, I think that first hour, like the kind of rise section, is really interesting and really good and super hyper kinetic. And then once it like tries to like slow down and be a drama, it just completely falls apart for me.
Yeah. I was pretty much disconnected even with those moments. Like I was watching the first time we see him perform and the first time we see the young girls go wild and the older people get upset about the gyration, thinking to myself, this is a scene you should like. Why are you not connecting? And I just was already taken out of it by Hanks's performance, by the hyperkinetic visuals, by just like being exhausted by the thing that early on.
Well, at some point in the future, we're going to both have to rewatch Moulin Rouge.
Okay.
And Moulin Rouge. No, I don't. I contemplated rewatching Elvis for this recording and then decided not to.
In our group chat, I came in hot with my hate for this movie.
Yeah.
And you suggested that maybe I rewatch it for a more tempered take. And I didn't say it in the chat.
That was not a sincere suggestion. I was antagonizing you. Okay. Let's be clear.
I thought that was sincere.
I was not being sincere.
You fucking
at all.
Dick.
No. No, Jamie, I'm at a point where like I very rarely need to rewatch something in a short period of time. Like, because I've done it. What was the last one I did it with? It was the fucking Doctor Strange sequel, where like everybody was, not everybody, but a lot of people were very enthusiastic about it. And I felt nothing in theaters. And then it popped up on Disney Plus. I'm like, fuck it, I'll throw it on one night. And then 30 minutes in, I was mad at myself. Like, why am I still rewatching this? I saw it 6 months ago. It sucked then. My tastes have not changed. It turns out I wasn't in a bad mood that day. This movie just doesn't work for me at all.
Yeah.
So I was just giving you
shit.
You
were just giving me shit. Okay, thank you. Because I was like, well, maybe I should. And then immediately I was like, I had such a fucking horrible reaction to this movie. Like, to sit down for another 2.5 hours of this shit would like, I might as well bash my head on a wall for 2 hours instead.
Yeah, I don't care for it. But no, I think maybe, I don't know, when we ever get a Patreon up and running, maybe that we'll throw Moulin Rouge in the mix and see how well it actually holds up. Because I suspect that Baz's flavor has aged like milk for me, and that I will not enjoy rewatching that movie.
Oh God! And we loved that movie. We like I you, me,
great
Chris.
Fondness for the music and the performances. I think mostly what I love is just like Ewan McGregor's voice, which is astonishing.
He's so good.
Yeah, I did a borderline serviceable version of Elephant Love Medley at a film festival karaoke party one time, and it was going pretty great until the couple of bars leading up to when there's a key change and he breaks into the Dolly Parton or Whitney Houston version of "And I Will Always Love You."
Yeah, it's tough. And it's a tough transition.
No, it's not that. It's that one of our staff members was famous and he was just there and just like 5 minutes before had been on stage doing like his astonishing version of the Whitney version of that song. That is like a showstopper. And it was only as we were leading up to that moment that I realized, fuck, I have to follow that doing the same song. And that the DJ did this on purpose to make me look like an asshole. But I did really good up until that point. I think I was very drunk.
Yeah, I mean, we all think we're doing a great job at karaoke.
No, I usually hate myself the entire time. And then people are like, no, it was fine.
Yeah, you know what people are really thinking.
No, I know what I can do and what I cannot do. And yeah, I can't follow Chase doing "And I Will Always Love You."
No.
No.
All right, so Elvis, don't watch.
Don't recommend, but again, a lot of people like it. A lot of smart people really like it and we're super into it, and I can't discount that, and it just really didn't work for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Jamie, here's something that I know really worked for you.
What's that?
Because this is fucking right in your fucking obnoxious wheelhouse. And that would be Triangle of Sadness.
Yep.
Yeah, of course you fucking loved this movie.
I fucking loved it.
I know you did. You know why? Because that's you right over there. Right there. For the listening audience,
that
I changed
is not
my background.
Nice.
Jamie.
It's not nice. Jamie, I don't live.
I follow you on Instagram and it's just constantly pictures of the food that you're eating.
That's fair. I eat good food though.
At least I trust that you actually eat the food, unlike this character in the movie who is, you know, posing for the gram.
She claims to be gluten intolerant right up until it's time to eat pretzels in a survival situation.
Right. Oh, I didn't even make that connection. That's good. Yeah. Well, you know. Not to generalize, but a lot of people who claim to be gluten intolerant are personally gluten intolerant, but
well,
they're not
also,
like biologically having celiac. Like,
you're going to eat pretzels if that's what is available.
All right. But so I'm going to warn you right now, Jamie, this is a cursory review of the movie. We should avoid spoilers for the second half.
Should
as
we?
Much as one can, as much as one can, or at least the last third, as much
okay,
as one can.
Sure. Fine.
So Triangle of Sadness.
Watch it. It's good.
It's good. So this is Ruben Ostlund, director of Force Majeure and The Square, and he's back with another satiric black comedy. Triangle of Sadness follows Carl, a male model on the decline, and Yaya, his influencer/model girlfriend, on their vacation aboard a luxury yacht hosting a group of upper-crust 1% motherfuckers. There's wealth, there's class, there's privilege, all are hilariously skewered, peaking with a centerpiece sequence where nearly everyone on board gets violently, horrifically seasick. And then the shit hits the fan and things take a really dramatic and unexpected turn toward the dire. Harris Dickinson and Charles B. Dean play Carl and Yaya. Woody Harrelson is the ship's drunk Marxist captain. Vicky Berlin plays the head of the ship's crew, Paula, and Dolly DeLeon steals the entire goddamn movie as Abigail, who is a cleaner who sees her position change dramatically in the second half. Triangle of Sadness premiered at the Cannes Film Festival last year, where it won the prestigious Palme d'Or, which was Ostlund's second Palme in a row, putting him in pretty rarefied company. It was released last October by Neon in the U.S., Neon, the boutique distributor who brought Parasite to the States and all the way to Oscar glory back in 2019. It is nominated for 3 Academy Awards, Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Original Screenplay, also for Ruben Ostlund. It is presently, as of this recording, available on VOD. Jamie, Tell me all the unexpected ways that you loved Triangle of Sadness.
All of the ways are expected. It's funny, and it's also, like, dour at the same time. The people that we're watching are, by and large, all terrible. But some of them are likable in their own way. It plays with power dynamics in a really fun way, from the beginning to the end. As you said, Dolly de Leon steals the whole damn show. Her performance as Abigail is amazing.
There was a lot of buzz because she had a bunch of nominations for supporting actress in some of the precursor awards leading up to the Oscars. And there was hope that she would get a nomination from the Academy, but that didn't happen, unfortunately.
Yeah, I feel like she should have.
It was a crowded field, Jamie. It was a crowded field.
Sure. Or whatever. She's good.
She's very good.
Like that whole third act, or third part, as it's demarcated in the movie, is dominated in my memory by her. I think she's great.
Yeah.
And also Harris Dickinson as Carl. He's awesome.
He's terrific. He's really funny and, like, hapless and kind of pathetic. And yep. I really enjoyed his performance.
He's like, he's well-intentioned, but he's stupid. He thinks he can fix his girlfriend, which is like a classic man thing. And she, as she like openly says that she's manipulative, he's like, yeah, I can fix that.
He's idiot. Trying, man. He's trying fucking the best idiot. That he can. He's not well equipped for it, but he thinks he's trying.
Very poorly equipped for it.
Yeah.
And whoever, I don't know the actor's name that played the Russian guy.
The oligarch who has the lengthy and fairly tedious argument and quote trade-off with Woody Harrelson.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's awesome. I love him.
He's very fun. It's a great performance.
Anyway, I love the movie. It does most of the things that I love. As I've described previously with, like, Everything Everywhere, it's a thing that is irreverent but also deals with tough issues. And I like that juxtaposition. I find it to be a compelling way to talk about difficult things.
I like it. I had a great time watching it. I think it's very funny. I love all of the performances. I think it's very didactic in its discussion of class and the upper crust and stratified class systems. And I think it gets a little tiresome after a while. And once the movie kind of like lays it out for you, like what the real stakes and the targets are, which is like maybe halfway through the movie. So like the first third is Carl and like Carl and Yaya together. Like it starts with him going out for like another modeling gig. And then the two of them they go out for dinner and then they have a fight. And then it's trying to figure their shit out. And then the second third is on the cruise ship with the wealthy people. And then the third is goes and does something else. About halfway through all the stuff on the cruise ship, I was like, all right, I get it. I get what the movie is saying. I get what it's trying to do. And nothing after that surprised me at all. It kind of like put all of its cards on the table and then continued to hammer me over the head like a blunt instrument. And I don't know, it kind of felt rote and like self-congratulatory, like patting itself on the back for fucking using a, you know, minigun to shoot fish in a small bucket. Like all the targets are really easy. And kind of the whole movie for me centers on that scene between Woody Harrelson and, this is not a name I think I can pronounce correctly, this is Zlatko Burek, who plays Dmitry, the Russian oligarch. And the two of them are just like trading barbs back and forth. And the Woody Harrelson, the drunken communist captain of the ship, is throwing like quotes from Lenin and other, you know, communist and socialist revolutionaries back at Dmitry. And Dmitry is countering with famous quotes from like JFK and probably Adam Smith and like other notable capitalists. And it's just like, yeah, this is the whole movie. It's just signifying. It's just a bunch of people reading their fucking Bartlett's quote book and like skipping to the chapter on capitalism and on class and on communism and socialism, and it felt very tiresome to me after a while.
I just
the character stuff and the actual like narrative drama I enjoyed, but the class commentary and satire after a while felt super toothless to me, and it had really nothing new to say, which is kind of how I felt about his last movie. His last movie, The Square, is a skewering of the high art world. And there's a couple of like showstopper fantastic scenes in there, but it just feels like he's not making movies about real characters anymore. Like Force Majeure, which I think you watched a couple of years ago.
Yes, I did.
Which is fantastic. I fucking love that movie. But like that was the last time Ruben Östlund made a movie about people. And this movie is largely not about people. They all seem to be like mouthpieces or ciphers for like whatever particular like class views he's trying to satirize.
Hmm.
And I say that having thoroughly enjoyed the movie.
Yeah.
But it was just in retrospect that it really kind of annoyed me a little bit. And I was like, man, I wish they were more like people and didn't just fit kind of so neatly into exactly what he was trying to say.
I hear what you're saying, and I don't think you're wrong. I would contend that Yaya and Carl are actual people. They're the ones who like experience an arc.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
But and nobody else is.
Correct. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. And like, Dimitri is the biggest, thickest outline cartoon character, obviously, because of his, like, the big performance and the Russian accent or whatever. But Abigail and Woody Harrelson and everybody and Paula. Oh my God, Paula.
Paula, wonderful performance. But yeah, she's in one role and then she tries to maintain that role in after. So there's some dramatic turn of events. Yeah.
Yeah. But I find the arc of and between Yaya and Carl to be compelling.
I greatly enjoyed it, had a lovely time, but just kind of found it a little scolding and a little patronizing and fairly obvious as it went on.
Well, now, some people need to be scolded.
Well, I'm not one of them, Jamie. And lest you remember that.
I will forever disagree. And continue to scold you.
Well, here's how the wine you picked made me feel, James. All right?
Well done.
For the only listening scene. Audience, I just changed my background again to the viewing audience. I hope you can deal with this. But yeah, the aforementioned show-stopping scene in the movie where the right around the middle section where the mega yacht gets hit with some major chop and one of the rich drunk ladies starts violently vomiting basically on the camera, and then everybody else starts sympathy vomiting along with her, and it goes on for so long. You didn't get to theatrically experience this, right? You saw it at home?
I saw it at home, yeah.
So I saw it at the Regal. Small crowd, like maybe 15 people, like some weeknight, but there was a young group behind me. None of them could have been older than like 22, maybe. And they all seemed to be really into the movie. But then this young woman who was sitting directly behind me when this scene gets started, she's like, oh no. Oh no, oh no, oh no. She's like, and she starts making like the sympathy vomit noises.
Oh no.
And like, so I was uncomfortable with them sitting right behind me because it was a fairly large auditorium. There was plenty of space that they could have been in. I'm the only person in the goddamn room with a mask. Do you need to sit right behind me? But whatever, that's fine. But then when she started getting upset and her friends were like, would you just shut up? It's fine. Just be quiet. You're not going to throw up. It's okay. And it had been raining that day and I had a raincoat on.
Oh no!
And I strongly contemplated just pulling the hood of my raincoat up just in case this girl booted all over me because she sounded like she was in a bad way.
Well, I'm glad you didn't get vomited on.
My wife committed a cardinal sin, which is that when she saw it, I guess she saw it a couple days before I did. And I knew that this scene was coming because like after the Cannes premiere, like everybody was talking about the big vomit scene. Tani, when she saw it in an empty auditorium, she'll want me to point out, she was live texting me basically once this scene started. And she's like, oh my God, is this about to happen? And she's like, this is so gross. And I'm like, watch the damn movie. She's like, nobody else is in here. And I literally cannot look at the screen and then 5 minutes later, I get another text. She's like, oh my God, it's still happening. It's still going on.
Yep. It goes on for a long fucking time.
It's pretty great.
It's one of the
all time great, mass vomiting scenes I've ever seen in a motion picture.
Yep. Perfectly executed. I enjoyed every minute of this movie.
Yeah.
It hits me exactly where I want to be.
Well, of course. Yeah. Because it's just as fucking pedantic and didactic as you like to be, Jamie.
That is correct, Scott. Thank you for noticing.
Of course I notice. I pay attention. The Triangle of Sadness. I don't know. I'm honestly kind of surprised at all the nominations that it got, because it's just like, it's not normally like, comedy is not something that the Oscars normally go for. And I mean, I guess if we look at Parasite's kind of historic wins a few years ago, that there's plenty of precedent for the Oscars to throw it to something that's like very class conscious and like a class satire. But then all of that extensive vomiting in the middle just really surprised me that the Oscars would swing for it. But here we are.
Here we are.
Here we are. I don't think it's going to take anything home on Oscar night. But then again, who knows and who cares?
Some people care, Scott.
Some people care. I'm not one of them. The only thing I care about is, I mean, I care that bad things aren't rewarded, and I'm in it for the yucks. I'm in it for Warren Beatty reading the wrong envelope and everybody from La La Land coming up on stage until the one noble producer snatches the envelope and has to go and explain to everybody that, no, sorry, fucking old guy screwed up, and or somebody gave him the wrong envelope, and it's actually Moonlight.
That's
I'm here.
That's rough stuff. Yeah, I'm here for the yucks too.
I'm here for, you know, Will Smith slapping Chris Rock. Mm-hmm. I was aghast and scandalized by it, but like, anything that makes the Oscars look dumb is great for me.
I was really glad to be in a room full of people watching that. Honestly,
that was special. That was really great. I still cherish friends of the show. Pri and Adam were there, and Adam has this great picture that he took of me and Pri just like glued to our phones, scrolling Twitter, trying to make some sense of what just happened.
Yep.
Because when it was originally broadcast, like, they tried to chop it up and they muted a lot of what was being spoken, because so much of it was Will Smith screaming profanities at Chris Rock.
Get my wife's name out your fucking mouth.
Yeah. Yeah, it was surreal.
It was.
And you know what else I'm here for is the Oscars just assuming for their 2021 ceremony that Chadwick Boseman was going to win Best Actor, not only for his amazing performance in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, but also it would be a posthumous award and a recognition of his terrific body of work, him having just died the previous summer. And so they shuffled up the timing of the show and they made it so that Best Actor would go last. And then Anthony yep. Hopkins wins for a truly extraordinary performance in The Father. But then, because the Oscars told everybody, sorry, even though we're still in the pandemic, we're not letting anybody Zoom in this year. And so Hopkins was like, all right, I'm 80. I'm not going. And so there was no one there to accept his award. And so the presenter just took it and walked off stage, and the Academy looked like a bunch of smacked asses. And I'm here for all of that. That's what I'm there for. And I hope there's more of that this year. I'm sure there'll be some kind of insane stupidity.
I'm glad we're all getting together to eat some pizza probably and drink some wine and have a good time.
It'll be wonderful.
Yes.
The low feller is even going to come up to my house in a couple weeks, and we're going to watch Top Gun together.
He's a little guy.
Yeah, he was like, I'm like, come on, you got to at least watch Top Gun. Your company fucking paid for it. You probably worked on the movie for all I know. He was like, yeah, I guess I'll watch it. All right, we should move on.
We should.
Content warning before we get into our discussion of women talking. The movie itself is a lengthy discussion of sexual assault. Therefore, is your content warning for any of those who may be sensitive to it. Let's have a lengthy segment of two men talking about women talking. That was awkward. I feel awkward that I brought it up.
It was not as awkward
as literally every audience has ever felt when you see executive produced by Brad Pitt show up in this particular fucking movie.
Yep.
Yikes, Brad. So Women Talking is the latest from child actor turned world-class filmmaker Sarah Polley, and it's an intimate drama adapted from a novel by Miriam Toews, based on the true story of a group of women in a Mennonite community in Bolivia. The film's title is Truth in Advertising, is just that. It's in Bolivia, yeah.
Oh, really?
Is where the actual events occurred. And then the movie is loosely adapted and is more of like taking the premise and treating it kind of like allegorical.
Okay.
And also like she needed to sell it around the world, you know. But so the film's title, Truth in Advertising, The movie is 100 minutes of women talking. And it's these women from this Mennonite community debating what to do upon the discovery that all of the men in the community have been systematically drugging and raping them for some time. The options that they have on the table are leave, stay and fight, or stay and do nothing. The movie is a true ensemble. It stars Rooney Mara, Claire Foy, Jesse Buckley, Judith Ivey, Ben Whishaw, and Frances McDormand, among several others. All the performances are extraordinary. It's one of my favorite movies of the last year. I highly recommend everybody see it. Women Talking premiered to rave reviews at the Telluride Film Festival. It was released in the States by United Artists around Christmas time. As of this recording, it is still in some theaters, though it's making basically no money at all and will likely be gone from theaters by the time this drops. So I hope you had a chance to see it. Otherwise, check it out on the VODs or whatever platform it ends up on. Jamie, I fucking love this movie and was broken and wrecked by it. What are your thoughts on the women talking?
Well, first of all, I'm sure that you made me aware that this movie was not available streaming anywhere, but I forgot.
I mean, I did say when we recorded a week ago that it was only in theaters. And it's on the little spreadsheet that I gave you that says all the titles that are nominated and where they're available.
I'm not saying that
and
I'm
on the
smart.
Calendar invite that I gave you for the Oscar party that I'm kind of hosting, there's a link that tells you where you can watch all the nominated movies. And it would have said Women Talking is only in theaters. So I think at least three times I told you that it was not in theaters is what I'm saying.
Sure. So...
Did you not watch the movie?
So this weekend, I was like, this is the last movie that I have to watch before Thursday. And I was hanging out with my partner, Genevieve, and I was like, do you want to watch this? And she's like, sure. We sit down on the sofa. I whip out the old phone to find out, to do a Google search and find out where it's streaming. Quickly find out that it's not streaming anywhere. And I'm like, fuck, when am I going to find time to go see this movie? I cut my workday short on Tuesday.
Wow, look at you. Good job shirking your responsibilities. I approve of that.
I went to the Ritz 5 for a 4:15 show before having my Valentine's Day dinner with my partner.
Oh, wow. Such a romantic movie to watch on Valentine's Day. Fantastic.
I was all dressed up for Valentine's dinner because I knew I was going to have to go directly to dinner from the movie.
I'm just imagining Jamie like walking up to the box office with like roses and like a box of chocolates and one for Women Talking, please.
Basically, exactly that.
Oh, that's so horrible and funny at the same time.
Yep.
Oh, this is the best story. This is so good. Why couldn't you have led with that? Because that would have really redeemed me getting hosed by this nasty bottle of skunk wine.
So then I sat down for that 4:15 show, yeah, knowing that I was meeting up at like 6:15 to go to dinner. And this movie's great. It took me for a whole ass ride. I don't know what I was expecting, but for sure, I was expecting some amount of, not action in the sense of like people blowing each other up, but like something other than just women talking, which is what the movie is. And not to sound pejorative when I say just, but it's a whole film.
No, that it offers nothing else. And that's not a critique. It's 12 angry women.
Right.
It's a talkie. It is a debate movie.
It would play incredibly well on the stage for that reason, you know, yeah. Like you can just have the hayloft as your set and just keep you there the whole time. And I think it would be incredibly effective. I was really arrested by Rooney Mara's performance.
Mm-hmm.
I was very disappointed that my beloved Frances McDormand was largely on the sidelines.
Yeah, I mean, I think her name attached to it helped get it made. She's been producing.
She was also a producer, yeah,
in recent years, and I think part of the deal was like, I'll produce this, and like, I'll take a small role, and you can put my name on the poster and put me in the trailer, and that'll maybe sell some more tickets.
Which is great. But I also love her and would have loved to see more of her. Not that I think she could or should have taken any of the other roles
right
in the film, but it was incredibly thoughtful and thought provoking and really sad, but also hopeful.
Yeah.
Ben Whishaw was fucking...
Ben Whishaw's lovely. I always like Ben Whishaw.
It really... Yeah. There was a moment where I got worried, like, this is a movie called Women Talking. It's about women making decisions, and it came close one time to making me think that it was, like, centering August's emotions.
Yeah.
And pulled out quickly from that dive and did a good job. I think it does a good job of centering Rooney Mara's, what's her character's name? Ona. Her perspective on that situation, which is the more important one and the less traditional one also.
But it's not just her. I mean, like, I think if there are leads, I mean,
between
in the movie,
August and Ona.
Oh,
in,
yeah,
in that for that sure. scene that I'm referencing where they're squaring up against one another.
It, yeah.
You know, he has like a big cry and it's talking about his feelings and how he's going to be affected by the actions that they will or won't take. But then it pivots quickly to really center her emotions, and her agency, which I really appreciated.
Yeah. Yeah. She's extraordinary. Claire Foy.
Claire Foy fucking kills
exceptional.
It. She's so good.
In interviews, she said that, I think Sarah Polley initially wanted her to read for one of the other parts. And she's like, no, this is the character I have to go for, because if I'm being honest, like, I am filled with rage just reading the script. And, like, I can't not be the angry character. Like, I have to be the one pushing for leaving, or at the very least, fucking fighting. And Jesse Buckley, I mean, the three of them are just exceptional. Jesse Buckley is, like, one of the most exciting, like, actors working right now. She kind of blew up in the last few years, and she's just extraordinary and so exciting and always so radically different in everything that she does. You probably would have seen her in, I'm thinking of Ending Things, the latest Charlie Kaufman movie.
I did not see it.
You should watch it. It's great. It's the Charlie Kaufmanist movie you could imagine.
I do like Charlie Kaufman. She's good in it. She's also in Men.
Boy, Men, I think Men is terrible, but she
did
is
you
great.
See, you saw
it? I saw Men, yeah. I think it's really extremely bad from a filmmaker who I really like. Like, I really liked Alex Garland's last two movies and the show he did in between, Devs. But Jesse Buckley is exceptionally good. And Men ends, like, the final scene in Men is like a body horror thing that I could describe to you, but it's borderline indescribable. It is one of the most repulsive things I've ever seen on screen, and it is extraordinary. And I still think the movie adds up to a whole lot of fucking nothing, but holy shit, the ending of Men is crazy. Anyway. Yeah, I just love this movie. And you mentioned that it would work really well as a play, and it's like kind of a knock that you hear from people, not about this as much, but like, oh, that should have been a play. Like, when a movie's just talky and it's not very kinetic or very action-y, and just like, you know, something that's very theatrical in that way. And yes, this would work very well as a play, but I think it works extremely well as a movie. It does things that a play cannot do, like you all of those incredible close-ups and just the tiniest micro expressions and all the detail and the nuance.
Well, and the flashbacks that they show you that these women are having to their trauma. That's not you're not capable of doing that on the stage.
Yeah, they are blessedly brief. And I was a little worried going into it that the movie was going to, like, focus on the trauma, and it doesn't. Like, you have glimpses of the flashbacks, but it's largely about what do we do with trauma, like, collectively? Like, how do we take it forward, and what choices do we make?
And the flashbacks aren't about what happened, right? The flashbacks are about the aftermath.
Yeah, it's about waking up and finding bruises you don't remember having.
And they're so brief, but so visceral and emotional. When I said that this would play well as on the stage, I don't mean to give the impression that I think it should be on the stage necessarily.
No, I'm not saying that's what you're saying. Yeah.
but you could adapt it for the stage extraordinarily effectively, right? You would just have to kind of adjust the try and find ways to convey that trauma without doing the flashbacks, and take a real intimate, uncomfortable look at that conversation without breaks. Because we get breaks in this movie, which is good, but I think on the stage you might want to lean into to not offering that.
Yeah, I'm glad you liked it. I saw it relatively early. I saw it at Philadelphia Film Festival, and I was just like wrecked from the word go.
Yeah,
it's just beautiful. Like absolutely devastated and enthralled by the performances. It is at times not funny, but like there is a sense of humor in some of the characters a little bit. I really love the performances from it's Judith Ivey and Sheila McCarthy, who play like sort of like the
elder women,
elders of this particular group. Really marvelous performances from like two actors who largely are doing like supporting roles. And to see them kind of show up here and really fucking own a handful of scenes that are kind of given over to them.
God, dude, the bit with she takes out her dentures. She's like, forgive me, they're too big. And then we get a flashback to her losing her teeth.
Yeah.
That one hit me real hard.
Yeah.
It's a hard-hitting movie, but I don't think it's one. You say it wrecked you.
Yeah.
It did not wreck me. It didn't ruin my day. It didn't stick with me in a way that like made me feel uncomfortable or unhappy or, make me need to chew on it for a long period of time. But it did resonate with me in like how we should treat each other and also like the ways in which we make decisions collectively. That bit really resonated with me as well.
Yeah, the stuff that really hurt is the Jesse Buckley character, who is the one advocating for staying and doing nothing, essentially. Jesse Buckley is such a powerful and at times like very fiery actor. And to see her in a role that is more essentially docile, like in the dynamics that they're talking about, like she's not docile in the group of women in throughout the movie, but she doesn't want to fight and she doesn't want to flee. And to see her kind of reconcile those two different dynamics and then some of the choices that she makes or has to make as they're reaching their decision, and then the consequences of those choices just really, really landed very hard. I just love the movie. I was so enthralled by it for a movie that's just, they're just sitting there talking the entire time, and it's so intellectually rigorous. You know, it for a bunch of characters who are like not literate. Like that's why Ben Whishaw is there, is because somebody needs to write down their ideas and their decisions and keep a record of it to help them in their decision making process. But it's so rigorous in how it interrogates all of the ideas and all the conflicting points of view and the pros and cons of all the potential outcomes. And it's not easy. Like I personally feel that the conclusion that they come to is the most logical and rational one. And in terms of like justice, it's the best choice that they could have possibly made. And yet it's not ever that black and white. The outcome is never foregone. And it's not like they made the right conclusion and, you know, all things will be happily ever after from here on out. Like it's still, like the trauma is never going away.
Right.
The generational damage is never going away. These women are never going to get over the horrible fucking things that these awful men have done to them. It doesn't give you any easy outs.
It takes on the topic of like the young boys and what the age cutoff might be and who's coming with them. And
right.
And it talks about all of that in depth. And there's ambiguity and there is no right answer, but everyone has an opinion. And so when we're making decisions, generally, we should talk about them and come to consensus. That was the thing that really, that I took away most from this movie was the intellectual rigor of it all and the ability to, and it resonated. obviously, like, the story itself doesn't particularly resonate with me. I'm a man, you know, and I've never been sexually abused. So this doesn't call back to personal experience, but currently I'm, you know, professionally operating in a collective of people that makes decisions together, and we talk them out together, and all voices are heard, even when they are loud and angry or possibly incorrect. That really resonated, as well as the fucking the performances, man.
Yeah.
Rooney Mara.
You're really down for Rooney, huh? Rooney's your girl.
I connected in a big way with her on screen and her relationship with Ben Whishaw.
Yeah. I have always liked her. She's terrific. The stuff that really, and again, as another man who has not been the victim of sexual assault, the thing for me that I personally connected to was the parental aspect of it.
Right.
And the concern of, like, we have to protect our daughters from this happening to them, but also, like you were saying, like when they're debating whether or not we leave, like at what age, what is the cutoff for our boys? Who do we leave behind and who do we bring with us? And like, no, we don't leave any of them behind because we don't want them to become fucking rapists, just like all these assholes who have been doing this to us. And all of the parental struggle and just the challenge of like, how do you protect a child and or how do you raise a child to be a good person in communities that you're horrified by? Really, really landed on me and really just like, it's not easy. Nothing about it is easy. And I find the like deft hand that Sarah Polley brings to the whole thing just extraordinary. There's never a heavy-handed moment in the whole movie. She never puts her thumb on the scale. It's always balanced. Every viewpoint that is expressed is like fully valid and correct and is allowed to like have an emotional truth behind it. And we never judge any of the characters who are on screen. I think it's a brilliant choice that none of the men are actually shown.
Yeah.
Like if we don't need to detract and it's not their story at all. Like for them to appear would also just allow the movie to have like an easy villain that we can hate or detest or like a straw man that they could instantly argue against. And like, other than August, who is by whatever like allegorical, you know, Mennonite community standards, like he's an ally essentially, as much as he can be. Like other than him, none of the perpetrators are depicted. And I think it's a brilliant choice. And I think the movie would be maybe more emotionally evocative and like maybe more palatable or successful if they made a decision to have the men show up. If there is a confrontation as the women are trying to leave and all the men show up and try and stop them and you get like the, you know, the rousing Oscar moment and Rooney Mara gets to give a speech or something and then they all get on their wagons and leave. And like it never takes the easy route.
No.
It always makes you work for it and makes you work to be empathetic to every single point of view, even if you disagree with them.
We didn't even talk about Melvin. And his like trans journey and the choice to be silent, until he's like not being dead named by people who should rightly be his ally. That one also hit hard, but was like understated in its presentation, was not like, as you said about, Triangle of Sadness, was not didactic, was not beating you over the head, was just like, this is a reality. This person experienced massive trauma.
Yeah, I don't know, man. It bummed me out in a good way, in like a life-affirming kind of bummer kind of way, where it's like, because there's hope too.
Yeah.
There's hope in the movie. There's hope for the very concept of democracy and community. There's hope that like we can collectively make a decision that hopefully benefits everyone if we just listen to each other.
And there's hope on both sides, right? Like there's hope for the women and children leaving, but August staying represents a ray of hope for the community that stays, because he is a teacher and can impart wisdom onto the next generation.
Yeah, it's great. I think it's kind of spectacular. It's just low key phenomenal, and I wish more people had seen it. And hopefully, any of the Oscar attention that it gets will just help more people decide to watch it. Even though it's a hard watch. It's not easy, and I can't imagine the difficulty of watching it if you're anything other than fucking stupid men like me and Jamie.
Yeah. If you personally relate to the experience of these women, I'm certain that it is difficult. Although I would hope, as I'm sure Sarah Polley would hope, that like experiencing this movie might allow for some amount of catharsis, or at least some amount of hope, right? Like that conversations can lead to positive outcomes.
Have you ever seen Stories We Tell?
No.
This is Sarah Polley's documentary about her mother that is one of my all-time favorite movies. We watched it at your house one time, but I think it was just me and Dee and Chris, and you were not present. Absolutely phenomenal movie. Sarah Polley making a doc interviewing her family members about her mom, who her mom in a way is kind of analogous to like Mitzi Fabelman. In The Fabelmans, an actor and a performer, but with her own emotional issues and issues with her marriage to Sarah Polley's father. And it's a family documentary that becomes a mystery that becomes something else entirely. And it's absolutely fascinating and beautiful. And you should check it out. You, James Rubin in particular, I think would really love this movie.
Stories We Tell. Heard.
Stories We Tell. One of my very favorites.
Well, yeah. We made it. We made it to the end of the Best Picture nominees.
We did. We made it. And nobody even yelled or screamed about any of it, which is wonderful.
No,
I yell about the Oscars, but no, there was no reason to yell. Why would one yell?
Well, you could yell about Elvis.
Yeah, but whatever, man. People like it. People like it. What am I supposed to do? A lot of people like it.
Sure.
Yeah. You know what? It's a good crop this year. I like 8 out of the 10 Best Picture nominees. And like, I love 5 or 6 of them. Like,
yeah,
that's fine. That's pretty cool.
It is. I agree.
You know, there's some things I would have loved to have seen get a little bit of recognition, but you know, shit happens. And the Oscars are not the be all end all of something's cultural impact or longevity or how far and wide it's seen by human people. So, you know, we live and we move on, Jamie. We live and we move on.
So do you think that, well, you had a fucked up bottle of this wine, so you can't really say if this wine paired with any of these three movies.
I mean, I think it pairs with the last hour and a half of Elvis, my particular bottle.
Just it's got like a, being
got
bad.
A hyper acidic, super salty cat pee nastiness going on that sure. I really didn't care for.
I would argue that my bottle pairs all right with Triangle of Sadness. Mm. That like that polished champagne feel of it all. With the wealth on display. Definitely no good pair with women talking.
No. I mean there's women talking you pair with sobriety. You pair with like keeping your wits about you and not trying to dull any of your nerves.
Correct.
Because it requires your fullest attention and you don't want to dull the pain that it may inflict upon you. You Correct. Need to feel it and live in it.
Agreed. So that wraps up our Oscars miniseries.
We have wrapped them up. This episode should drop on Friday the 10th. The Oscars will be broadcast on Sunday the 12th. And tune in on Monday the 13th, because right after the Oscars wrap up at 11:30, Jamie and I are recording a surprise Oscar response roundup episode. No, I'm kidding.
We're not doing that.
That's
not a thing that's going to happen.
No, that is not a thing that's going to happen.
So next time on, and for the following 6 episodes, we're going to be diving into the Court of Master Sommeliers curriculum, which so many of you have heard me obliquely complain about, or talk to Scott about how we, break down wines and how we understand them in the context of the global market or whatever. And so I've picked out 6 wines that would be fair and quote-unquote testable through the Court of Master Sommeliers. And we're going to talk a little bit about the value of what the court finds to be classic and what I find to be lacking in its curriculum. And all of this is a lead up to me taking the Master Sommelier Diploma Theory exam on May 22nd.
You got this, Jamie. You can do it. Jamie. Rudy.
Had a study session on Portugal this past week, and it was rough.
Yeah.
Portuguese wine is difficult.
It's not your strong suit. It is my recollection.
No. I mean, my strong suits are Italy and the United States, and everything else is like in a blur. But we're gonna fucking do it. I'm gonna go and I'm gonna sit the exam, and at the very least, I'm going to have a good time doing it. Because once I'm there, once I'm in the place, I'm surrounded by a bunch of wine people who baseline I generally like.
Yeah, and what choice do you have? And is it Dallas again?
Thank God it is not Dallas. No, not going they to the changed Big D? It. No, not going to Texas. Going to Portland, Oregon this year.
All right. Well, so what is our first bottle then? For do you have a name for this miniseries? For Jamie's history of CMS mandated wine curricula.
For now, it's CMS curriculum. I'll come up with something better.
I don't know that you will, but you'll come up with something.
Thank you, Scott.
Something for your tortured and brutal.
Fuck you, buddy. Our first wine is the 2020 Riesling from Donhoff. This is their Niederhauser Klamm Cabinet bottling. It is available at crushwineco.com for $27.99 plus tax and shipping.
Well, we are approaching prices that I personally find palatable again, so thank you.
You're welcome. I promise to exceed those prices in the coming episodes.
Terrific. I make no promises about reimbursing you for the cost of all these wines. Well, to go along with Jamie's curricula from Ye Olde CMS leading up to his Master Somm exam, I thought I would take it back to school as well. And so for my side of the miniseries, we're going to follow Jamie's lead, and we're doing some canonical film school classics, some of the most important feature films, experimental films, art films, and documentaries from the first half of the 20th century, some of the things that were major landmarks and that were huge touchstones in my film school education and that I imagine are still being taught in most film schools today.
Fuck yes.
And just for funsies, we might even sneak in a couple of the very first motion pictures ever made, the Lumiere Actualités.
I'm excited. I'm excited for both sides of this miniseries. I think it's going to be a fun time.
You are really going to be into Train Approaching a Station, Jamie. Man, that one is so in your wheelhouse. You're going to fucking love that movie.
Am I? I'm worried that you sound a little sarcastic right now.
No, it's just like 60 seconds long and they plunk down a camera as a train approached the train station. and it's like the thing that like famously, we'll get into it when we get into it. It's fine. We're done. We're done. We're overdone. We're done. Wrap it up.
Thank you everyone for joining us.
Thank you.
It is and always has been and always will be, hopefully, a pleasure podcasting to you all. Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us if you have questions, concerns, or any international reviews you'd like us to read on air. Make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me. Our social media presence is thanks to James Jamie Harrison Rubin III. That's him. That's right me. Over there. Our art is by Ross Connor. Thank you so much, Ross. And thanks to Rebecca McCracken for helping out with project management and operations.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine, watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise. We'll be right back.